Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. You know, before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the rise of outlaw country music and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision in her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. Hey, it's Bobby Bones. Hey, I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the St. Jude kids. St. Jude's doing incredible work fighting childhood cancer. And because of donations like the ones that you give, families never receive a bill ever from St. Jude for treatment, travel, housing, food, none of that. Help St. Jude stop childhood cancer. Become a partner in hope. Get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. It's going to look great on you. So join all the doctors, researchers, and me in this fight. All right, text the word Bobby. It's only six numbers to 785-833. Again, text the word Bobby to just these six numbers, 785-833. This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for four lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with four lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.
I was fortunate that, you know, people believed in me here or there. And I, you know, had a couple of record deals that was on Capitol, you know, didn't pan out. But Tim Dubois felt like, you know, I was a good enough singer that me and Ronnie Dunn might make some noise.
We've been trying to get Kix Brooks in here for a while, and this is episode 409. And there was no real promo except he was just on the road forever.
Yeah.
And that's it. But he was super cool to come over because he didn't have anything to promote. So he finally just gave in to our constant requests.
My favorite ones are when they have nothing to promote and they just come over.
I always feel like they're doing it because they feel sorry for us, though, because we've been asking for like 8 years. They're like, fine.
I'll do it.
Fine, I'll come over. Brooks and Dunn, you want to do the first five number ones?
Yeah.
All right, 1991, Brand New Man. Oh, I saw the light. I've been 1991, back. My Next Broken Heart. I'm working on my neck. Man, I don't ever play that one whenever I play like all their hits. That's a jam. That one gets overlooked so much. 1992, Neon Moon.
I spend most every night beneath the light.
1992, Boot Scootin' Boogie. Oh, no, see, no. Come on, baby, let's go. And 1993, She Used to Be Mine.
I did my part to break her heart.
Couple quick notes here about Brooks and Dunn. They formed in 1990. They're the best-selling duo of all time. 20 number one songs. You know I love them. We all love them. About Kix Brooks specifically. Grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana. I mean, he's lived everywhere. Lived obviously in Louisiana, but also in Alaska. We talk about that. In Maine. His dad and how much of an influence his dad was. He had some record deals before Brooks and Dunn, but just really enjoy Kix. The reason I love Kix, because I can go, hey, Kix, what's up? He takes it away. Because he does this too.
Yeah.
He knows what it's like to be a good guest because he likes it when he has good guests.
I like it when you can get somebody on what they're passionate about. And yeah. Whenever he starts talking about wine, he just like really gets into it.
And I know nothing about wine. So it was like a teacher teaching like an infant.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so you drink it? What hole? What hole do you pour it in? All right. Kix Brooks. You can follow him at Kix Brooks on Instagram. Here he is. One half of Brooks and Dunn. Kix Brooks.
We should start with what we were saying right before we started recording, where I was looking at some of you guys' crowds, and Ronnie will send me a video occasionally if it's like an absurd crowd.
Uh-huh.
And he'll say, what you just said to me, I don't know how this is still happening 30 years later.
So he didn't send you the one where nobody showed up?
He doesn't. You know, he's like a gambler friend that I have who never tells me about his losses.
Never lose. Yeah. Nobody in Las Vegas ever loses.
Ever. But it's like there's a popularity for you guys together now that I don't think in my ticket buying life I've been able to see. Because if you guys started in 90, mm-hmm. right? I was 10 years old. I couldn't buy tickets then. So that I really didn't. But since I've been like an adult,
uh-huh.
I don't think you guys have ever been more popular, in my opinion, than right now. Do you feel that now?
Certainly in terms of, you know, the tour that we've done. I mean, when in 2010, when we thought we were quitting, you know, we did kind of a last go round and we did good business then. Up until then, you know, short answer, it's been a long time since we blew out Coliseums like this.
It's like a passion crowd too.
It is. It's really fun. And I didn't for a while last year. And then I just started looking at, you know, these are not all people that were supporting us 30 years ago. You know, and I just asked how many of you missed your first Brooks and Dunn show. And it blew my mind. I started doing it every night because it looks like 70% of that crowd, it's their first time. And that's what really makes me scratch my head and go, wow, what got into y'all? You know, I mean, is it our reboot album? Is it just this 90s thing that people have just kind of latched onto a lot of 90s music? You know, that whole format's obviously has really kind of had a resurgence as well. And for me, at the risk of even sounding like I would compare what we do to the music or the legacy. I mean, when I first got into country music, Willie and Waylon, you know, even before the Eagles were the guys that really pulled on my strings. And I was in college, you know, and started going to Willie picnics and stuff like that. And it was just this whole, it was like, you know, down country Woodstock stuff going on all the time. And it was just so much fun and it was country and it was good. And Waylon and Willie just had this thing about them that was really cool. And, yeah. And I just wanted to be a part of that. And then I started, but I was also, you know, I mean, I was hooked on Allman Brothers and Charlie Daniels and all that stuff. I mean, Charlie wasn't considered country back then, not like Nashville country. Right. You know, those guys were playing their guitars loud and rocking. And, you know, I grew up with Hank Williams down the street, but literally, you know, Rolling Stones and all that stuff. When you started having bands, those were the songs you could play. You know, you could go, dun, 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 you know, five of us playing guitars in our band, we're all doing that lick, you know.
It's crazy to think, again, you're talking about the crowds and you're like, I don't know why. I really have spent some time thinking about this. I think it's a little bit of the reboot album. I think it's I don't think it's as much of the 90s country comeback as maybe, even if you really think that. I think you guys would be here regardless again. I also think you're both still really good. I think if you were just if you were still just playing because you were only successful in the 90s, some of the artists don't have it still physically, don't have the ability to. You guys are also so funny on stage. I just think you still are good. And if you weren't good, I don't think that the crowds would still be as big, because I've been lucky enough to watch you guys or play alongside you guys. Or, but again, I think it's, you guys are still, you're both so tall too. And that angers me. Both of you. You're both so tall that it does. It's very upsetting. And you're in cowboy boots at the same time when you're so tall. And I consider myself a pretty tall guy, but nothing there. But yeah, I was thinking about that too, because you guys are selling out arenas still. And it's not like, you mentioned the Eagles. The Eagles, where it's like, I went to watch the Eagles, and I was like, this may be the last time I ever get to see the Eagles, so let me go. Mm-hmm. I feel like we got like six more rounds with you guys. Like, well, see, I just don't feel like it's any of that. I just feel like it's a good show. We like the songs. And I think like the Combses and the Casey's vouching for you guys to an even younger crowd, I think that probably helps too.
Sure it does.
That reboot album was pretty genius.
That was a good pull. And it was fun to do. Because we didn't, I mean, for years, we've just, you know, you grind and you stress over songs and this and that and whatever. And it was so neat of our manager, Clarence, really reached out to those people. So it wasn't like we had to get in the middle of
the awkwardness of asking.
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, that was a real important part of it. That really mattered. And they came back with all those acts that were like, all these guys are great, you know, and what I was really impressed with was, and I mean this in all sincerity, there was not one person that walked into that studio, most of them we'd certainly never worked with before, and most of them we'd never met. And just out of the blue, I mean, Ashley McBride literally was driving her car out. I was singing You're Gonna Miss Me to her over telephone in the car, and we got a key before she got to the studio that day. She walked in, we said, hey, hugged it out, went in the vocal booths and cut the song. And it was just a lot of, there was never any ego. There was never any, even, there wasn't any, even any fan love or anything going on. You know, I mean, everybody was there was really nice. And, you know, this is really cool. You know, we're getting to do this, but everybody was real pro. I mean, you just got the feeling these are young acts that really got their legs under them. They're really confident. They're not cocky. They're just, we're all just kind of working here and having some fun. And it was a great experience. And it, with Dan Huff, it took no time to put that record together. That's the other thing. Just making the record. You're not grinding for weeks and weeks, you know, stressing over every mix and all that.
Was that a big part of you guys getting back together and then going on the road and like formalizing, hey, we're doing this again, that record? Or were you guys already working on
doing it again? We'd done 105 shows with Reba.
Before that you had? Was that that? But had you guys been out on your own tour? Like just you two with your own band?
Not what you would call a tour, but really it was about, it's probably 3 years. It was probably, I'm guessing, probably 2013 when we kind of stopped in 2010. We started getting some offers to, you know, play. I think we played, you know, Super Bowl and in New Orleans and not Super Bowl, but the Superdome and, you know, Daytona and just some special things that came up. And, you know, we just realized this, we don't have a beef with each other. This is kind of fun. And we definitely still remembered how to do it. You know, we still look across at each other and go, I don't know, man, which we have since day one, because we didn't know each other then. And,
right,
you know, we still stay on separate buses just to have that kind of, you know, good to see you again when we hit stage that night. It really is kind of that way. It's not like we hang out all day or anything, you know.
People feel that my radio show, and we've been friends for 20, I mean, we've been together forever and 20 years, that we just go home and all eat dinner together. And
yeah,
if we didn't have some sort of, again, I used formal separation.
Right.
We would kill each other.
Yeah.
But I love them.
Yeah.
And we've been at it for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, they think, oh, you must go on vacation together. No. If we did that, we would not be able to do what we do at the level that we do it at. And I'm sure it's like a second marriage with anybody. If you're with anybody that long, especially like you and Ronnie, and you travel that much together, like you have to invest in that, right? To keep it healthy.
Yeah. And it's, you know, we've been told by our, you know, our biggest Merle Haggard, you know, just kept reminding us that you guys got a thing. He goes, it's just a thing. And you need to respect that. You know, I've told the story before, but, I mean, I remember on our last run, we were in Woodstock, New York, and Merle agreed to play with us if we would play with him every night. But he got to pick the song. So it was never Working Man Blues or Silver Wings. It was always a really obscure thing that we'd have to learn, you know. He'd make us grind. So I jumped up on the bus one day to get our song, and he's sitting there, you know, having a smoke and looking out this window. We had a sold-out crowd at Woodstock, and he goes, sit down. He goes, I need to talk to you. I said, okay, because what the hell are y'all doing? I said, I don't know, Merle. What the hell are we doing? He said, look out there. So why in the hell will all them people come out here to see you? Would you quit? So, Merle, you know, Poncho and Lefty's probably one of my favorite songs ever, you know, and it's a great video. I mean, you and Willie are like great friends. Y'all made one album together, okay? I've been running. Ronnie and I, Dunn and I met on a Tuesday and wrote our two first hits on Thursday and Friday. We didn't even know each other. You know, we managed to grind this out for 20 freaking years, and we need a break here. I said, and you made one album with Willie. And he goes, well, we only had one hit. I said, okay, Merle, what's our song? Damn it, I love
you,
man.
That's funny. I've spent a lot of time in Shreveport. I'm from Arkansas, so we go down to the boats.
Uh-huh.
We drive down, first place you could gamble, so that's where we went. Mm-hmm. And so by doing that, I also played a lot of ball in Shreveport. Being from Arkansas, we play baseball. Shreveport's the closest Louisiana big town. Mm-hmm. We won't say city, but big town. Mm-hmm. And Shreveport, like childhood home. What's home as a kid for you? What town?
Shreveport.
Literal, the Shreveport. Well, yeah. What school?
I went to Riverside Elementary. And literally, you might have heard me tell this story, but two blocks away over on Audubon, Billie Jean Horton lived. And after she was the last wife of Hank Williams. They got married in Shreveport, and they got married down in Baton Rouge. I think got married twice in one day. It was kind of unheard of at the time after Hank got divorced from Audrey. So he died, and then she married Johnny Horton. And their daughter, Nina Horton, was my age, and we were in grade schools together at Riverside. We still stay in touch. I mean, Billie Jean, she was a number. For a kid in grade school, when she pulled up in that white convertible Cadillac and those leopard skin pants, it's just like, wow. Hello, Mrs. Horton. But Nina hired us, Billie Jean, actually $5. You know, we got $1 a piece. There's five of us in the band, but we like saying $5 at the playground. That was our first gig in their driveway. And their little white houses just like we had. I mean, to think Johnny Horton and Hank Williams, this is a little white house. You know, it's probably a 3-bedroom on just a plain old, you know, suburban Shreveport street, just like us. It seems so average. You know, but going inside and seeing those gold records and those guitars and portraits of Johnny Horton and over the fireplace and all that stuff, it was real special and real cool. And it really set something inside of me going, that's for sure.
You being able to see those, did it actually let you know that it was possible to do that?
That's what I mean. It seemed like something that it wasn't just some pie in the sky, star in the sky. You know, it was something that people did, you know, regular people like my dad, you know, they just lived down the street, but they were playing music. And I mean, from the time I can remember, our family sang as much as we talked. You know, you get in the car, you start singing songs. It was just a thing. So that really, you know, and we always had bands, you know, and from grade school on up.
Who bought you your first guitar?
My dad did, but my grandmother bought me a ukulele when I was like 6 years old because my mom died when I was like 4. So I spent a lot of time with her, and she was real musical, and my cousins were too. And I remember that came from Sears and Roebuck. It was $9.95. I'll never forget. It's white and had red stripes on it. Really cool. And I had a songbook, and I just learned to play chords and sing songs with that ukulele. I learned how that worked. But I really wasn't strong enough to play a guitar. My dad got me a steel string guitar when I was 10 or 11. And
my grandma raised me too for a lot of my life. What was your grandma like?
She was salt of the earth, both my grandparents. You know, there was never anything like divorce or anything like that. It was never even something to be considered, you know. They were just country people. My great-grandfather had been the town doctor there in Marion, Louisiana, which is kind of northeast Louisiana. And they still lived in that house. It was a big house right in the center of town, which was kind of the hospital at one point, you know. And they were just – my grandfather had the Thompson General Store just maybe 100 yards from the house. And, you know, went with them to buy stuff for it all around in Monroe or wherever, you know, the big cities. You had to get jeans and shoes, and they sold everything, food and whatever. But he was also the vice president at the bank, and he was the mayor. So they were, you know, but they were – it was funny. And in a town, I think they had about 600 people there. But they had friends they played bridge with. You know, they had a little boat. And my grandfather, if he was at the bank that day – everybody that came in were the fish biting. And when he got home, me and him threw that little tin boat in the back of a pickup truck, old beat up pickup truck, and took off to wherever we'd heard. And we fished all the time. That was just a big deal for us.
When you get a ukulele and you're a kid, where do you play it publicly first?
For my grandparents, we just put on shows all the time. You know, that's for them for sure.
And so when you get a guitar, you're 10, 11 years old, mm-hmm. When do you decide to go out and play for somebody that doesn't know you super close?
Whenever your dad, who is real proud you could do that, you know, we'd go to, you know, just cousins' houses and stuff like that and, you know, bring your guitar, you know, and he'd, you know, play, you know.
What do you make you do it?
Like, play Sync the Bismarck. There, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, especially those Hank, Hey Good Looking and all, you know, Hank and Johnny Horton songs, just because they were down the street. I learned a lot of that kind of stuff. And Johnny Cash was a big deal for me.
Yeah. And Johnny Cash, a big deal for me because, again, being from Arkansas, my grandma would always be like, all right, he's like you. I'm like, well, except he's not, but yes, but Johnny Cash, you know, even Conway Twitty, who, you know, named after Conway, Arkansas, but he also Louisiana, I mean, Conway Twitty, Mississippi, mm-hmm. you know, that area, there were all those artists that my grandmother really looked up to who I guess I thought was just, they were current until I got a little bit older and realized uh-huh. they were just her favorites from when she was younger. Uh-huh. What about your grandparents or your dad? Like, what music did they really like that you just naturally took on?
My dad liked country, but he liked hits, you know, like I can remember he'd stop and get a 45 and bring it home, you know, and like Harper Valley PTA or, you know, something that was a hit like that, or, you know, King of the Road, you know, I can remember him bringing that home. Just as far as listening to Nashville country music, not so much. He probably gravitated to, and his dad sharpened saws in a sawmill in Urania, Louisiana. I mean, and his dad got struck by lightning fishing when he was 8 years old and died. And his mother was a first grade school teacher. So he came from very humble background. But I think when he was in the Navy, he really picked up on big band music. He loved Gene Krupa and stuff like that. So, you know, he had a sophisticated kind of side to him. He loved Delta blues, real old school, Lead Belly on up, you know, through old Delta blues, and then whatever hits were on the radio that he'd heard about, he liked that stuff. But he wasn't really a Nashville country music guy.
Did you graduate high school in Shreveport?
I didn't. I went to boarding school.
Where?
In Suwanee.
Here?
Yeah, it was a military school when I went there for 2 years. And
did you go to? I don't understand. Help me understand boarding school in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you a bad kid?
I was. You know, it was my first stepmother was the one that really kind of got under my skin. We didn't get along very well, and it just caused a lot of problems in our family. And I was, you know, I wasn't necessarily a class clown with weapons, but I probably stirred up a...
I would think you would. And you still stir it up. So, I mean, that's why...
You're still, yeah, I got in trouble all the time.
Yeah.
But just, you know, I was partying at a pretty early age. And
how do you feel about those 2 years now? Are you happy?
I went 4 years and I wouldn't give anything for it. It definitely made, especially 2 years of military. And that was during the Vietnam War. And we kind of started a rebellion, basically brought down 104 years of tradition at Suwanee Military Academy, became a boarding school for my last 2 years. And it was pretty crazy that, you know, pulling all that off. It was sort of like Taps, if you ever saw that movie. Yeah.
When you finish there, then what do?
I went to, my uncle was the dean of business at SMU. And so he encouraged me to come to SMU. And I did for a year. My dad wouldn't buy me a Ferrari, so I couldn't really get a date at SMU. So I went back to Louisiana Tech where all my friends were and had a great, great time there. Yeah.
Did Terry Bradshaw go to Louisiana Tech?
He did. He did. And Phil Robertson was, you know, played starting quarterback.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And Terry was his backup. Terry and I are still really good friends. And he said he'd have never thrown a pass if Phil hadn't gone duck hunting. But he did. He quit and went duck hunting.
Is that the truth?
Absolutely the truth. And it's funny because he got approached by the pros after that because he was such a strong quarterback. And the story goes, I guess they came down from Oakland to see if he'd be interested in coming and trying out. And he said, don't y'all play football the same time we're duck hunting and the same time them country boys do? He said, yeah. He said, then I'm not interested, you know.
I saw Terry at the Opry a few months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't really know Terry sang.
Yeah. You know, he had a top 10 record, I think, wasn't it?
Must have been before me.
I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. Yeah, he had an album out.
Did you know him back then, or did you guys meet later on because you're from the same place?
We did. We actually we met because of Tech and his daughter Rachel. You know, I'd met her, and and we started having a golf tournament at Tech to raise money, and just had a lot of fun and got to be friends.
Yeah, he seems like a pretty funny guy.
He's hysterical, and he's always just. That is so him.
Hang tight. The Bobbycast will be right back.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct-to-consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com.
Tecovas.com. Tecovas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How do the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as the Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts. That's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Backrack as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer, and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, to take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
And we're back on the Bobbycast.
Did you have Louisiana people that you, I mentioned Johnny Cash and like Brooks Robinson played third base for the Orioles way before me, but he was from Arkansas.
Yeah.
Did you have Louisiana people like that to you that you were like, they're from where we're from?
Sure.
I really like, I admire what they're doing. Who would that be?
Well, obviously, Hank Williams and Johnny Horton and, Merle Kilgore, you familiar with him? Mm-hmm. So Merle was Hank Jr.'s manager and also wrote Wolverton Mountain and I was just
he was a writer and he managed
Hank Jr. But famous, and I met him through the CMA board the first time and we got to be great friends. But yeah, he was famous for, you know, he had big rings on all his fingers, you know, this jeweler Diamond Dan, you know, made it really, really outgoing, you know, over the top, really fun guy. But you say, Merle, you doing good, man? Everything okay? And he go, are you shitting me? Show you those rings. Yeah.
What was this? I mean, when you mentioned a guy like that, I think about Nashville when it used to kind of be like that.
Oh, yeah.
Loud. And it's still its own way of loud, but like, loud, you would just see somebody and know that they
did lost
something.
A lot of our carny factor.
That's carny, sure. That's yeah, it's definitely. Yeah. What was it like when you moved? What was this town like when you moved here?
I'll tell you, the For me, it was, I just wanted to be a songwriter in this town. That's really, I mean, most all songwriters have some dreams and, you know, they play their songs. We've gotten some recognition. There's exceptions to that. But most songwriters like to think of themselves as artists. I mean, I did, and I had a couple of record deals before Ronnie and I got together, but not because I was that great. I don't know. But I started singing a lot of demos, you know, for stuff like that. But the town, the ability to – my first publisher was a guy named Don Gant. And, man, he would hold court every day. We'd write songs all day. But he had been at Tree Publishing and was responsible for some of the great careers from Roger Miller and Mickey Newberry, got Sonny Throckmorton, people you may not be familiar with, but people that – Harlan Howard, of course. They were all at Tree – I mean, they owned independent publishing, but there were still great publishing companies like Combine, where Christofferson and, you know, Waylon and all those guys were a little smaller company. But when we were done at the end of the day, people would start piling in that door, and Don would always send out for a few cases of beer. We'd just pack in his office and start passing the guitar around. It would really make you want to write something special, because if that guitar came your way, or Don said, "Did you write anything today?" But at the same time, even if I'd written something that wasn't that good, he would find that one line in a song and go, "Man, wait a second. Second verse. What was it you said?" He goes, "Did y'all hear that?" It's like, and all of a sudden, he would make you feel like he might not tell you it was a great song because it wasn't, but he would also make sure you knew that's what you need to be. That's a great line. Give me a whole song full of that kind of stuff, you know. It's a great teacher, but also by the end of the night, we're all well-oiled. Then, you know, Mickey Newberry or Ray Van Hoy or some of those guys at Throckmorton who are just writing this brilliance, they get the guitar, and then you got the opportunity. But man, it was all up and down the street, and where's it happening kind of thing. And I don't, you know, there's so much you know, I don't sound like an old guy, but there's so much concrete where there were little houses all the way down Music Row, and you just wander up and down. You could hear it a lot of times up and down.
People just doing the thing.
Yeah, playing, you know, it's going, or and somebody come running down to your publishing company and go, "Man, come on down to Combine. You know, Waylon's down there and they're singing, you know, and da da da," that kind of stuff is going on.
Do you remember when you moved here, like, and again, you're in the majors now because you have all the great songwriters around you, which elevates at least, hopefully, you to get to their level. Do you remember the first like song you wrote where you were like, "Man, this is special. Like, I have now reached a new peak. I've learned and I've written this song." Do you remember the first great song you feel like you wrote?
Honestly, I had quite a few number ones at that point, but I think Red Dirt Road was a time when I really put the period on that song and went, "This is a freaking hit." And it's really saying, it's, you know, Ronnie and I did that together, and he actually, it was just a place where we talked about, really got real with each other, talked about where we came from. Like, you know, he was telling me about El Dorado. I was telling him about where my grandparents was. That's where he is. And somehow I was telling him about driving those roads with my grandfather, looking at timber, you know, what he was going to cut. And I said, "Man, that dirt was just so," he goes, "I know it was up." I said, "That'd be a good name for an album." So now we got to write a song. and we kind of puttered around at it three or four times and never really got more than a line or two. And he got off the plane. We had a gig in Sacramento, and we flew to San Francisco and got off the plane, and he handed me a cocktail napkin, and it had those lines about, you know, drank my first beer and, you know, wrecked my first car, tore it all to pieces, something about Jesus and, you know, life ain't just for high achievers. And I went, he said, "What do you think?" I said, "I think it's freaking great, man. This is exactly what we were talking about." And I jumped on a bus and, you know, wrote pretty much the music and the verses. He had already told me about Rural Route 3. You know, that's kind of when we kicked around. It's where he came from. And he came and knocked on my bus, had Terry McBride, and said, "Man, let's go get a steak." And I said, "You got to hear this song, though." And we both just kind of slapped it up in the air, and I couldn't wait to record it. It was really fun to put it down too.
Did you ever write a song and go, "This one's special"? Then you recorded it and you're like, "I think it's lost what we were trying to do. So let's do it again." Or
I think more just sometimes when you write songs, for a living and songs get recorded. You know, Don Gant had a plaque on his desk that said, it's not as good as the demo.
Like demo-itis, but a lot of my friends, yeah. It's like, you know, yeah. It's, you ever hear, yeah, it would just be tough if like you feel it and then you, even like comedy songs, like if I play them live and we try to record them, I'm always like, it doesn't sound as good when I recorded it. Like, it, and it probably does, probably sounds better.
Yeah.
But because it's like live or like if I'm creating something on the spot, it just feels newer and fresher.
You're married to the thing. And I would never mention what song or that was, you know, or whatever, because it's, I mean, it's the greatest honor of all for somebody to risk their career on something you made up, you know, as a songwriter, you know, but it is demo-itis. You just get here used to hearing it one way so many times. I remember like Modern Day Romance. I wrote that with a Dan Tyler, only song we ever wrote together. And we had both had, he wrote Bobby Sue on the Oak Ridge Boys album. And I had a cut that I'd written on there and that was actually my first cut. Called Old Kentucky Song.
Ever.
Yeah. And which was pretty lucky to be on a million selling album because
you could still make money.
Even your songwriter royalties, you know, all of a sudden Don started paying me $100 a week and I'm a professional songwriter. You know, that's really, really where it went from. But man, I really believed in Modern Day Romance. I said, man, this song is cool. It's got a good vibe to it. And everybody seemed to like it, but nobody would cut it, you know. And finally, Gant said, look, I'll cut it on you. Said, and he produced Buffett's first five records. You know, he did Come Monday, did all the backgrounds. He was a great producer. And I said, wow, that'd be cool. He said, we'll get you a record deal. So let's do it. He said, you sing it great and da, da, da. So we did. We cut it, actually got a film company interested, cut a demo on it. I mean, a video on it, and was about to put it out as an independent thing. And Worley called and said, hey man, Dirt Band just cut this song. He said, it's a freaking hit. Okay. I'll throw mine in the trash because I'm a huge Dirt Band fan. And Jeff Hanna sang the heck out of it. And anyway, it was, you know, sometimes things work out with songs, but you never know. Yeah.
Where did Kicks come from?
It was a couple of weeks before I was born was what I was heard. I was trying to bust out of there, you know. I don't know about you, but 9 months was long enough.
I was trying to stay in. I was trying to hang. I knew a good place when I had it. I was the opposite.
I don't know. Fetal position wasn't really my thing. I wanted to stretch out.
With my, because I, you know, Bones is not, my real name is not Bones. It's Estel. So Kicks, nickname as a kid or nickname later?
No, I was always Kicks.
Always? From a young kid?
From the time I was born, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But not your birth certificate?
No. Eric, I'm the third. My son's the fourth.
Is he Kicks? You call him Kicks as well, though? Is he Kicks Jr.?
No, call him Quattro.
Why do they call, but they really call you Kicks? Did you kick?
Not really. Call him Eric. Yes, they've always called me Kicks.
Because you kicked in the womb, because you came out a baby. It's because you kicked. You mess so much. I don't know if you're kidding or not.
No, that's the truth.
But you do understand you mess so much that sometimes it's hard for, like, that's why I'm looking at you like, okay. So Kicks came from, you were always Kicks.
That's correct.
Okay. So you're.
If you can find any defiance of that, Bobby.
Okay.
I'll give you full credit on your.
I have no defiance. I just.
Because I've removed all of that. So you won't. You won't find it.
You just. A couple of my early stories here. The first person played the Opry. You won't remember this. You've done this 10,000 times with 10,000 people. I was doing stand up and I was about to play the Opry for the first time ever. And you were there and you came in the room, my first room, and said, hey, and we're like, congratulate. And I was like, that's freaking awesome. And I thought it was so kind of you to do.
That was you.
Exactly. That's right. It was me. The time before that, I
urinated. Did I get your name right?
Billy Bones. Yeah. You call me Billy Bones. Yeah. It was nice. I peed next to you at a urinal in Texas once. Remember that?
Next to me? Man, I remember everybody that pees next to me.
Austin, Texas. Me and you right beside each other.
I'm going to have to call BS on that one.
I did. You were at Case 101 in the radio station down there, and I was working at Kiss, and I was in, and I was like, I didn't even know that you were in town. I think you may have been.
You didn't try to shake hands or anything, did you?
I did not. Not right then. I let you. But it was like, were you doing a solo project 12, 10? 2000. Did you do a solo? When did you do a solo? Your solo thing like when you put out your record
after Brooks and Dunn.
Yeah. Or
that would have been, probably. Well, we last toured in 10, so it would have been 11 or 12. Yeah.
That's when it was. That's when we urinated beside each other.
Okay.
Probably 11 right before I moved here. Yeah. Wow. I think you remember now, don't you?
I do. That
you,
was
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Yeah. You were peeking over the corner. I saw you there.
The Bobbycast. We'll be right back.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. TECOVAS.com.
TECOVAS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How do the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as the Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts. That's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Backrack as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer, and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest. Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, to take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
This is the Bobbycast.
I've never been to Alaska. It's the one state I haven't been to now. Just went to Maine for the first time.
Really?
It's awesome.
You know, I lived there in Maine.
I do know that. Yeah. And New Hampshire did that. Never been there. But I've not been to Alaska.
Yeah.
But you lived in Alaska. You worked in Alaska.
I did. Spent a year on the pipeline up there.
That's crazy.
Took a break from college. And my dad was a pipeline contractor, built pipelines all over the world. He's actually a part of the team that designed the Alaska pipeline. And his background was in testing, and so was mine. But basically, when you test a pipeline, except for just a couple of suspended pipelines in Japan and here and there, pipelines are all in the ground. So when you test a pipeline, you fill it up with water and you put a lot of pressure on that water. So if it blows up, it just blows out, a hole in the ground and the pressure dissipates immediately. There's really not much damage involved. When you've got a pipeline, the biggest pipeline in the state's 48-inch diameter. Alaska pipeline's 56-inch diameter, and it's on stilts. So when you fill that up with water and something bad happens, we did millions of dollars worth of damage testing that pipeline. It was really, really a exciting and some real dangerous work. But
what was it like to live up there and do that for a year?
It was crazy. I worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for almost a year without coming home.
Was it to save money?
And yeah, absolutely. So you didn't have to pay Alaska taxes. I sent all my money home. And I got home and bought a hot Camaro and a new guitar, and I could get a date again.
Are you a guitar guy, as in a nerd? Like, do you really like love old guitars?
I do love old guitars, but I'm not a collector. You know, I've got a couple of, I've probably got, you know, 4 or 5 guitars that are like from 51 and earlier. They sound really cool. They still play great, and I love the way they sound, but they don't really amplify very well. You know, most of the guitars that I play on stage, J200s are kind of, there was a couple of days that I got guys that play guitar in the band that had a bunch of acoustics just stood out front with the band playing by yourself, you know, and J200s is that for strumming. And right now, a lot of songs, I'm the only guy playing acoustic guitar. So, you know, for a good, even big strum sound when I'm playing rhythm, I love J200s. And I was playing a gold, Les Paul at the gold top Les Paul at the time. And, for the stuff I played electric. I mean, in college, I was the only guitar player in some of my bands, you know. Now I got 2 great guitar players that run circles around me. And so I play acoustic and sing and, you know, do what I do, but it's fun. People ask me all the time, how many guitars you got? And it's not tons, you know, I probably have 20 or 30 guitars maybe.
That's a lot of guitars.
It is.
You have a music part of the house?
Yeah, I got a couple of music parts, but I have guitars everywhere. I mean, there's not a day in my life that I don't pick up a guitar.
I was going to ask if you still play around the house ever.
Yeah, I do. And
you still enjoy music?
I still love music, and God love my wife, because I give myself concerts some days, you know, where I just play a lot of songs that just remind myself, especially, you know, you just get in situations, whether it's on stage with your friends or whatever, and you go, oh, I love that song. I need to remember how to play that, and, you know, that kind of stuff.
You're still driven to pick up a guitar and just play for fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's not always the case.
It's just, man, what do you do to shake out your yayas in the morning? I mean, what do you do to, you swim laps in that pool or what?
Sometimes.
Yeah. I did this morning too,
yeah.
But it's not the same as just singing my heart out for 2 or 3 songs, to really put my heart into some music all by myself and just sing and just really give it to the air.
Do you still keep notes if you get an idea, like a songwriting idea?
Oh gosh, yeah.
You still, yeah.
I keep.
How often do you write?
I write something all the time.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, but it's finishing songs that's the work. And that's what takes the time that I'm like you. I've surrounded myself with money spenders and I love the work that I have, you know, even, you know, just getting ready for a tour. You know, I do a radio show too, as you know, and got the wineries rocking pretty hard. And that's something that I have give quite a bit of attention to. So I just kind of in the morning, I start going through all the stuff and, you know, I call it checking the traps and, just, you know, it gets in the way of really spending a lot of time. If I get focused on a song, I need 2 or 3 days to really get from top to bottom to feel like it's any good.
Explain this winery to me, because I've never tasted wine.
Uh-huh.
But seems to be a pretty popular thing. Uh-huh. Wine and coffee, 2 things I think are catching on nowadays.
It's pretty popular.
Yeah, too popular.
Yeah.
But I drive by your place if I go play golf over at Troubadour.
Uh-huh.
And I see people out there sometimes not even drinking wine, just hanging out, sitting out there on blankets and stuff.
Yeah.
So what the heck's happening over there? Because I've never actually been there except driving by.
Yeah. Well, it was never a goal of mine to have a bar. That's a lie. That's a lie, because that's how I got to Nashville, honestly. When I graduated from college, a good friend of mine, the most popular bar in Shreveport where I played all the time, it's a really cool club, about a 300-seater, and on the weekends it was blowing up. But he was losing money on the weekdays because he was trying to hire acts, and people, you know, don't go out to bars, not in a lot of towns during the, you know, keeping a bar going, a big entertainment bar, it's hard. But he wanted to sell it, $5,000. So my dad and I were like best friends, and I called a meeting with him, though, because I wanted to borrow this money. I didn't have any money, but I had this idea. I was going to be the house band. You know, it wouldn't cost anything during the week. Weekends, we're blowing it out. Could make a lot of money. This is kind of working. So I went in there and said, hey, Dad, here's my plan. He said, da-da-da. I gave him the whole rundown and whatever like that. And he's sitting there behind his desk smoking his cigar, kind of nodding his head. And I said, you know, but I need $5,000. I said, I was hoping maybe you could co-sign for it. I said, okay. So, well, that's not going to happen. He said, really two things here. He goes, the first one is, I think you got a lot of talent. He goes, I believe in you. He said, but you don't want to be a big fish in a small pond here in Nashville. In Shreveport, there's not a handful of bands doing any good. And really, if you want to prove to yourself and everybody that you really got what it takes, you need to go to Nashville or New York or Los Angeles and see if you can really make it in the music business. I said, okay. Makes sense. Okay. And the second thing, you don't know a damn thing about the bar business. So, that got me out and going.
When you move here to Nashville, how soon after that, after he has that talk with you, like, we ain't doing a bar, but you got to go because you're good enough to go. You just got to go. You chose Nashville, obviously. But how long until you get here and actually feel like this is home or that you can actually thrive?
Well, it took a minute because not like it did for a lot of people. I was fortunate. Jody Williams and I were roommates in military school. And Jody was running Charlie Daniels Publishing Company. His sister was married to Charlie's guitar player, so he kind of got it in there. Me and I could – it was the first place I'd ever been because I worked in New Orleans for 72 nights before I came here that I couldn't take my guitar and a handful of, you know, newspaper articles that I'd gotten and at least let somebody – I could play for somebody and get a gig making some kind of money like in the airport kind of thing here now. But – when I got to town, this was the first place I'd ever been where I couldn't make a living playing my guitar. I mean, it was
and because everybody was trying to do it.
Yeah, it was just there weren't any,
and there's not enough places.
Yeah, if there's a cover band or something, but everybody played for free. Everybody's trying to get noticed, you know. I mean, I auditioned and played at the Bluebird all the time. It's actually where, you know, like in the movies, I got discovered. Bob Dole, who wound up managing Garth Brooks, was working at ASCAP, saw me playing at the Bluebird, invited me to his office the next day, introduced me to Don Gant, and Don got me, you know, my first couple of cuts and gave me a publishing deal.
I mean, that's the Nashville story. You're
it
at the
is.
Bluebird.
I know.
Somebody sees you. Did you? Were you like a pitcher who was being scouted? Where you knew the scouts were in the stands that night?
No. I really didn't have anything going. And what I learned was my songs weren't that good. I'd written a lot of songs, but and me and David Lee Murphy were sweeping floors for Charlie Daniels. We got $30 a night for sweeping the War Memorial where the Musicians Hall of Fame is right now. I'm not kidding. And we worked security. We worked the barricade behind the barricade to keep people from jumping on the stage. And then we'd work the dressing room at, you know, when after the show was over, making sure nobody got in there or anything. And then we sweep the floors.
That's Did you ever almost give up?
No. I shouldn't say that. I mean, there were probably times, you know, if you're a songwriter and I had, you know, like four number ones and quite a few cuts and had some, you know, good years, but it was 10 years before I met Ronnie. And there was valleys in there where I went, I'm not making that much money. I got a couple of kids now. Is this, you know, where does this go from here? You know, I'm not really hot right now. I've got a publishing deal, but, you know, $300 or $400 a week, whatever I was making, you start looking around going, it's, you know, and that's what people do. A lot of people throw in the towel. I never did. Fortunately, you know, every time I just start to get a little discouraged, something good would happen. And just enough to keep you in the game. You know, I was fortunate that, you know, people believed in me here or there. Even people that were doing advertising jingles and that kind of stuff. I always had some singing going on too. And I, you know, had a couple of record deals that was on Capitol, you know, didn't pan out, but people were aware. And I guess that's how eventually, you know, Tim Dubois felt like, you know, as a good enough singer that me and Ronnie Dunn might make some noise.
Okay. Back to the wine. Like, what do you sell there other than wine? I mean, what do people pay money for when they go there?
Wine is our big deal.
I would think it would be one of the major ones.
Different kinds of wine. So we bring hundreds of thousands of pounds of fruit in from all over California.
Not all grapes.
Grapes.
But yeah. All grapes? Yeah. You'd say fruit. I don't know if you made like pineapple wine.
We don't, but we do make a couple of fruit
I know
wines.
Nothing about wine, Kick. So, so I've never had a drink of alcohol, so I'm going to talk to you like a kindergartner.
You can ferment oranges. You know, people in prison do that all the time.
In the toilet. I know. I mean, I've seen those prison shows. Yeah, yeah.
If you've ever left fruit in your refrigerator too long, anything will ferment like that, okay?
So when you say fruit, though, you mean grapes.
I mean grapes,
okay,
yeah.
But that's a wine
we have
term.
16 acres of fruit of grapes, and we use every grape we grow. But we can't grow a lot of these grapes. They grow in California, you probably heard of Cabernet or Merlot or Chardonnay. Those are actually types of grapes, and they need that climate like in Northern California. They like it hot in the daytime, but at night they need to shut down and rest. And our nights here are warm enough that the flavors of those kind of grapes just kind of blow off at night. So we grow certain kinds of grapes that do well here that are hardy, but it depends on the varietal.
You're telling me those are different grapes, like Cabernet, Chardonnay. What was the other one you said?
Merlot.
So those are just different grapes?
They're different kinds of grapes.
Green, purple. Those are the two kinds I know.
Yeah. So there's white. That makes white wine and red wine.
Did you know, Mike, that's what it was? I didn't know that. There were different grapes? No, we're idiots. No, I mean, we're
not idiots. Just something you're not into.
Huh. Yeah. So can you do the – when people go, they taste the wine, they spit it out, and they're like, there's some tree bark from a pine tree. Can you do, are you that, is your palate that distinguished?
It's not, I'm not a sommelier by any means, but I can tell Cabernet from Sangiovese grapes that I can tell certainly Bordeaux wines from California wines, you know, certain big areas that have real distinct taste to them. I can tell the difference.
You
in
can
that
taste
kind
an
of
area?
Stuff. I can. Some areas.
Wow.
You know, because some areas are real, you know, some Italian wines, you know, spend a lot of time in Italy drinking
like
wine. They have, yeah, exactly. You know, the difference in New York and, you know, pizza and Chicago
pizza. You
know
what? Fair. Because I definitely can.
Okay.
If you were to give me a piece of New York or Chicago deep dish, I could tell you the difference.
See?
I definitely could.
That's what it's like. It's like you start there, and then if you're really into pizza, you go, well, okay, this Papa John's is not the same. Well, what's the difference? You know, that's how some people would go. You can't tell the difference. Yeah, you can. Mm. You know, right?
How did wine? Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. I can.
Yeah.
How did wine end up being your thing, though?
Well, I'm from Louisiana. So I started drinking at a very early age. And I like wine. It's great. You know, it's great with food. That's a big deal with wine is pairing. If you start doing that, there's certain because of the acidity and red wines and white wines and, you know, a great Cabernet. If you really like steak, it pairs great. One thing that wine does like good wines, nice wines, you know, what makes a great wine? Well, one thing is what's called a long finish. And if a wine has especially a Cabernet or a Merlot or great steak wines, if they have a long finish and you like the taste of that wine, you take a big sip of that and then you cut your steak, you taste that wine with that steak. And it's just a great pairing of food and drink. And that's all part of it. You know, you really learn to pair, you know, some like Sangiovese, a wine we make called Red Fox Red is a great, what I call a table wine. And there's a lot of great Italian table wines, which are just great with cheese and crackers. You know, it's a great pairing that, you know, just drink a little wine. And it's also something fun with your friends. You know, you cop a little buzz, you start talking about some stuff you might not have been talking about before. And just, you know, it's nonsense, but it's fun.
That is, you do wine, you sell wine, but people go out there just to hang out too, right? They just sit in the field.
Most people are drinking.
They are.
Yeah. Most of their children are, you know, at least the
I do
five,
see kids
the
out
five
there.
And 6 year olds.
You don't sell wine to the kids.
We don't sell wine to the kids. And it's hysterical online. You know, the rare complaints that we get are because, you know, there's not enough things for their children to do.
At the winery.
Yeah. You know, we're trying to drink here, you know. Could you please set up a bouncy, you know, house or something for the kids so, you know, we can drink in peace?
Do you have one of those lives where you can go places? Because if you have the cowboy hat on, it's over. We know it's you immediately. When you were on the ball cap, I would know it's you, obviously. But I would think that because your cowboy hat is such a large part of your persona, that sometimes people don't go, hey, Kix Brooks.
They don't. It's rare. You know, we did, like I said, we did 4 years, 104 or five shows with Reba in Las Vegas. So Ronnie and Reba, both very recognizable. They would always take a car from their rooms around to the back of the Coliseum and go in. And I would come out of my room just for enjoyment, would walk through all the slot machines and whatever by the crap table where I would play every night after the show, you know, walk through the crowd that's in line for our show, literally, excuse me, pardon me, through them. And sometimes even walk in and check out the merchandise room, which is, they're all right next to the Coliseum. Funny. Not one time in 4 years, 104 shows, not one time did one person, no matter how many times they'd been to that show. And we keep a record of that. You know, some of them have been to those shows 30 times or something. Recognize me.
I don't think it's because you're not recognizable. I think it's because what we recognize you for is so big, with the cowboy hat and the boots and the, and now you're just hanging out.
Yeah.
You know, if I saw you at Starbucks, I'd be like, yeah, that's Kick. But because you are always in the cowboy hat, people see you publicly.
Yeah. Looks just like him, only older. You know?
It's the perfect life of celebrity. You get to be famous when you want to. And if you don't want to, you just put on a ball cap. I would imagine George Strait can do that sometimes.
He does do that. And I wasn't going to mention him, but since you did, I remember somebody came up to me and said, we're on the sideline at an NFL playoff game in Dallas. And somebody goes, is that Strait over there? And they're arguing, no, it's not. I swear it's not. It's not him. You know, and I finally walked over and said, hey, George, how you doing? He's good. He has ball cap on, you know, but yeah.
Let's take a quick pause for a message from our sponsor.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit Tecovas.com. Tecovas.com.
Tecovas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How do the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as the Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts. That's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Backrack as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer, and the birth of outlaw country music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, to take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
Welcome back to the Bobbycast.
I was playing golf at a pro-am with a professional golfer from San Antonio.
Uh-huh.
And he plays with George some.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, George lives down there. And he said that they were in Ireland playing golf together once. And they had played and they went to a pub. But there was a guy doing some covers.
Mm-hmm.
And he was playing George Strait songs. Uh-huh. And George was there. And the whole time, he never knew that two tables down, when there were like 11 people in the whole bar or pub, that George Strait was sitting right there.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, because George wears a baseball cap and nobody recognizes him.
That's funny.
I went to, I had to think of the name. There's an island, a small island that my CFO has a house. And I went and stayed on this island. And George had a house that was right next to it. And you have to like take a boat to get to the island. I'm sure you've been there if you have a house there. Do you have a house there?
I don't know what you're talking about.
There's an island. It's like in the Bahamas.
Oh, in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably Baker's Bay. That's it. Where George is. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
You ever go over there?
Yeah. I fish in the Bahamas a lot.
Really?
But I haven't been to Baker's Bay.
That feels like a real
very close to there. Andros and Exuma down there.
Do you still fish a lot?
All the time.
What's your favorite kind of fishing?
Bone fishing, probably. Yeah. I like blue.
It feels like a mobster thing. Like you kill somebody.
Yeah.
Like bone fishing. Yeah. What? I don't know. I know lake fishing.
I like blue water fishing, fly fishing, you know.
Got it.
Long casting. I fish in Alaska every year with my son, you know, I have for 12 years, I love fly fishing for when the salmon are running, you know. I mean, those are big fish and they put a whack on
really?
It. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But bone fishing, you know, you can walk for 5 miles in a foot and a half deep of water in those flats out there. And it's just really fun because it's sight fishing. You can see them and they're traveling across and then you're kind of stalking. You've got to get in the right position where you can make a 50 or 60 foot cast in the right spot. And
50 or 60 foot in the right spot?
Yeah, and the wind's always blowing down.
What's
there
the
too.
Bone part of it?
They're just called bonefish. They're not fish eat.
So
know?
Literally, it's they're like bonefish grill. I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, right.
There you go. I went. I grew up fishing a lot, but lakes never, never ocean, never went to a beach, never. But also didn't fly fish a lot. But we went, and I know Johnny Morris a little bit, who owns Bass Pro, and he was like, "Hey, you should come up. You should stay up here. Let me know when you're going to be in town. I'm going to come see you guys." And so we're like, "Johnny, we're coming up." And he's like, "Okay, cool." And so first of all, he's super nice and sets us all up with fishing and golf. And he goes, "I'm going to send you guys to the honey hole." I don't know what that means right then. And I was like, "Okay, great." I'd figure if Johnny Morris is sending us over, it's fishing, it's going to be legit.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody comes and gets us in a van and goes, "You know, Johnny doesn't let many people go to the honey hole. We still don't know what the honey hole is. We don't know.
It's got to be where they're at, though.
It's got to be where they're at. That's what we're thinking." Got it. And so they give us our rods. We're fly fishing. And it's probably as big as this room here. The whole pond, the whole hole. It massive trout. Every inch of you throw. You. It's the only time in my life. It's cheating because it was so stocked that as soon as a fly would hit. Wada! We're just jerking them out of there.
Are they lake trout, you're saying? Or is this
they're massive lake trout.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking, we used to have a trout truck go by and drop trout off of Mountain Pine. Now, these trout were small and the trout truck would open, they'd all pile out. And you catch those, you just pull them up. You got to have trout stamps, game wardens watching, it's a whole thing.
Right.
But this, the honey hole with Johnny Morris, it was like sharks. They were huge. That's what I think about when you say Alaska, like Alaska fishing. The fish is bigger, there's more room.
And the trout get huge up there. When we go, you know, end of August, 1st of September, you know, the sockeye have all kind of died out there. The ones you see jumping up, the bears are catching in their mouth and whatever. But they're all dying out. And they've all spawned, and those trout have been eating those eggs, you know, the whole season. And they're 8 and 9 pound rainbow trout are not uncommon. That's a big fish. Yeah, that's a big fish.
So, okay, I just have a couple more questions for you. Yep. What every once in a while, whenever the last night, for example, I was sitting back here on the back porch, back area, and I was like, "Dang, look at that! It's pretty cool. Like, I got a nice house. Like, I've done some pretty good stuff in my career, and I don't slow down enough." Probably to acknowledge that now. I have a wife. She slows me down sometimes. Do you ever just go, dang, I'm famous and rich and got lots of songs and it's cool?
I quit doing that a while ago.
You don't wake up in the morning like, oh, good morning, I'm famous. This is pretty cool.
I feel like I would if I were you. That was awesome.
No, I mean, you'd expect me to say all the humble things that you would expect me to say. And that's really the only answers that I have, because I'm really not that impressed with myself. Honestly, the one thing you learn in Nashville, whatever your dream was here, whatever you hope to accomplish, which for me has really exceeded any reality dreams that I had. You know, I mean, you got a dream in your heart, you know, but that's kind of keeps you going. But to think that, you know, all that stuff would really kind of come true. What I realized that all the things that I do, play guitar, sing, you know, there's people that are so much better at it than me in this town. And if you, there's not many people I think that are real with themselves that don't feel that way, unless they are really the best singers here. The very best singers here, which I don't think that's necessarily my talent. I do feel real fortunate that my singing was so bad in the first 5 years of our career, just because I had just been playing and screaming in bars, you know, and you get on a big stage and I just had no control over my air, basically. And I really think talking on the radio for the last 17 years has really helped me, especially when you're doing a 4-hour show. And you know this from forever. You can't just be huffing and puffing the whole time. You got to find your air somewhere else in order to have any quality of voice. And that started translating into my singing. And it's really made being on stage a lot more fun, because I can kind of go through a whole show and feel like, yeah, you know, I sang pretty good tonight, you know, which I wasn't feeling that way early in our career. Fortunately, I had a great singer standing next to me. So, you know, he pulled most of the weight. And in the studio, I could do it. But getting on stage, bouncing around, I'd start huffing and puffing. It just wasn't very good. So I guess a long answer to a short question is I feel blessed, but I'm very humbled by the success that I've had with, I guess, what actual ability I do have. I think probably, if anything, I like to think that I've got a good ability to communicate, and I'm not intimidated by the stage at all. You know, I'm not that great at it, but I got a lot of confidence. So by the end of the night, I do feel like, you know, that crowd's really on their feet clapping because they had a good time and I had something to do with it.
Why radio?
Because I was basically asked, again, I'm a communications major, and I was always a fan of radio. Like a lot of people, was always a fan of countdown shows. And I kind of played around with it a little bit over the years. When I say played around, was asked to host an overnight show or something here and there. And it was just kind of fun to talk. And, you know, ABC approached me when Bob Kingsley, you know, and them got sideways. And Bob's one of my dearest friends. He's the first person I called and said, hey, you know, they said that, you know, you're maybe sideways on your deal and you're going to do your own thing. I said, I would never even try stepping into your shoes without your blessing. And he said, man, I think you can do this. I think you'll be great at it. And it was such an eye-opener. You know, I mean, I'm used to listening to myself singing, going, that sucks, and trying to make it better. But when I started air checking myself on the radio, I was so bad. Just everything I thought I was doing good sucked. And I guess part of just being able to notice that and not thinking you're doing great when you're not, kind of helped me get to a level. I couldn't believe they didn't fire me for the first couple of years. It was just really awful. But, you know, a lot of affiliates hung in there and whatever reason. I mean, at least I can listen to myself now. And I really enjoy doing it. It doesn't wear me out. It used to take me hours and hours to do that countdown show. And now, you know, just, you know, getting through the copy, I really kind of enjoy it and love my team. And I would imagine you feel the same way.
Nah. Do you, not at all. Do you do it from home?
No, I have done it from home during COVID. You know, I did it. We all worked remotely like a lot of other people. But I built a studio down in the old RCA building and the original RCA building and right across from Chet Atkins' office. And it's cool. It's all like turn of the century, mid-century furniture and everything. It's real cool. Quirky. And I like going down there. I like hanging out. We talk about the business, what's going on, whatever, even not stuff that's on the air. But it also gets me in the mood to do the show. And when bits come up, I think about, that's cool. But, when we did that, I try not to do that very much. I did learn of... Yeah, I got sent to interview school back when, Disney owned ESPN. So I don't know if you've ever done that, but
interview school?
Yeah.
No. Well, I need to go though, people.
One of the most amazing things that I've ever done.
But what do you do? What do you do in interview school?
For 2 weeks, this guy from Canada who is really good at it, we listened to all the great interviews of all time and where even the people that are considered the greats, Larry King and Barbara Walters in particular, here's the mistakes they made. Here's where this could have been world-changing. But here's, a lot of things, simple things like double barrel questions. If, and you see a lot of local news people ask 5 questions of somebody, when the tornado came through, what'd that sound like? I mean, did everybody run for cover? It's like, did it tear the top off the house? Which in that kind of question, it doesn't really matter that much. But when you're really trying to get to the bottom of something, and of course with sports guys, they don't want to talk anyway. They just want to do that. They want to compete, is what they're doing. In our business, we love talking about ourselves. I mean, that's where we come from. So you don't have to ask much of a question to pull my string and, you got to shut me down at some point and ask another question. But in that world, it was real interesting just to get some basic tools. If you'd like to get an answer to something, ask that one question at a time. And the people that were really good at it are people who would ask a question and then wait. Because that's where Barbara Walters, one of the things as good as she was, She asked Teddy Kennedy. She got the interview after he was accused of cheating on his wife. And her first question, did you cheat on your wife? How will the Kennedys survive this? Bang. He's a smart guy. He goes, Kennedys have made it through thick and thin and da 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 da. She asked him, 10 questions, but never stuck with did you cheat on your wife? It's almost kind of like Barbara Walters is a legend and did tons of great interviews and whatever. But he just gave us examples of, if you want an answer to something, wait for the answer,
My favorite thing to do is to sit in silence because I can't do this to you because you know the tricks. But if I'm with someone, I don't mind awkward. So if I'm with someone and let's say you're John Smith, who I'm interviewing, if I ask a question, then I'll just sit and then you'll feel the need to fill time because you'll feel awkward. And so what happens is people will just start giving the greatest answers because I've sat in silence for a few seconds. Mm-hmm. But you're so comfortable with yourself, I can't use those tricks on you because you're just staring back at me like, all right, what you got next? What you got next? But that's pretty cool that you went and you just got to watch all the greats. I had to go to like the library, watch those old movie, I forget what that, I watched like old Jack Parr Tonight Show episodes. Oh, yeah. What was that thing called? Talking about the black and white machine, but I would do that. And then I would watch, then YouTube changed everything. So now you just watch it. I just watch all my old interviews and go, that's what I want to do. Just like that guy. Yeah. I'm my own hero. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Well, look, I'm super pumped you came over. I was talking to Mike and I was like, hey, what can we promote of Kixes? And what he literally said was, we'd been working on getting you for a while, that there was really nothing to promote. We were just happy you were coming over. So thank you for coming over.
You bet. We're glad we got to visit a little
bit. Yeah, me too. Are you guys going to do are you guys going to go out again? Are you going to do a whole tour, Brooks and Dunn, massive tour? Let's go.
I mean, I don't see why we wouldn't really.
When you finished, were you like, I can't wait to go out again in a few months? Or were you like, oh my God, I need a break. We'll figure that out. The rest of it later.
We did 19 shows with Scotty and Megan Maroney. And people go, gosh, it must be grueling. I mean, Like, you never worked on a pipeline, did you? you never stood waist deep in mud with a shovel from Candle Cane. And my dad, he would always find the hardest, roughest job that was on the pipeline. And there's some really dangerous, really bad jobs out there. He had me, I mean, I had a chainsaw cutting 1,600 railroad ties a day at one point. I mean, I'm pretty good at sharpening a chainsaw and keeping that sucker running.
Gave you the gift of perspective.
Yeah, absolutely.
You didn't know how invaluable the gift was going to be at the time. That's like me. I roofed houses forever and I did maintenance on golf courses. And it's like, this sucks. But now it's like, I just appreciate everything.
You roofed houses?
Oh, yeah.
Cred, dude. So I built some stuff. Sucks. Oh, man.
Started off as tear-off crew. First of all, cleanup crew, then tear-off crew, then... After a while, I figured out how to fix a nail gun. So they let me actually use it because I was always, you can't use the nail. Because, you know, there's a compression gun. They're like, and so I figured out how to fix it. And so once I fixed it, they knew I could use it. So then I started actually roofing houses.
All right, Bobby, you got cred.
No, I have no cred. Right, no cred.
If you were on a freaking roof, roofing houses, you got my respect, dude. Roofs and drywall, anybody that's done either one of those for any length of time.
And we did seawalls too.
You got credit.
Seawall sucks too.
Seawalls.
Oh,
where were you?
On the lake and river in Arkansas. Oh, okay. We would go and we would, to do bids, we'd drive the flat bottom down.
What lake?
Like Hamilton.
Okay.
So we'd go down Lake Hamilton and we'd look at people's seawalls. They had a crack. Mm-hmm. We'd go knock on the door and be like, hey, there's a crack on your seawall. We'd make a bid. And if they were like, okay, cool, we'd go and it was heavy buckets. It was just, but again, have perspective.
Yeah.
And here we are sitting in a nice air conditioned room with your big face right here behind
there
me.
You go.
Celebrating the day.
And I went to Ozark Boys Camp for like 5 years.
What'd you do there?
Mount Ida, Arkansas.
Mount Ida is like 20 minutes from Mountain Pine. They were our main rival.
Yeah. Oh,
in
really?
High school. Yeah.
I'll be
darned. Very close. Very close where I'm from.
What did I do?
Yeah. What do you do there at that camp?
Everything. You know, they had one of those things. You had skis that were bolted together with roller skates on it. One of those lines that went down until you smashed into the water down there. Rope swings. They had a little golf course there. Had a baseball
Golf
field. And do I golf? Heck yeah.
Golf. Oh, I didn't know you golfed.
Yeah. I'm a member out at Troubadour and golf club of Tennessee.
Those two are nowhere near each other. You're driving all across the state to get to both of those.
You know, I've got a winery that backs up to Troubadour.
That's true.
See?
Well,
my ambition is to be able to play golf in the evening, drink all night, play golf in the morning, and never leave the campus. See?
But I feel like you're almost there anyway. You're almost there if you're at Troubadour and you have the winery.
That's what I'm talking
about. Yeah, but do you live over there?
No, I live in Forest Hills. That's what my wife said. Do you really need another house? I went, absolutely.
All right, Kix, thanks. I really appreciate the time. There he is, Kix Brooks. Go get some wine, everybody. Get on Kix. Put on the tab.
Thanks for listening to a Bobbycast production.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop before attending your next concert. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink, shop new styles. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. TECOVAS.com. You can probably spell it. You probably know it. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without fingersticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.